Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
Welcome to Strange Familiars. How are you doing tonight, Allison?
I'm doing well. I'm going to move my microphone back in its proper position.
Oh, yeah.
Get a crick in my neck.
Octavian was here. He messed up your positioning.
Makes sense.
He recorded the patron episode with...
Did he? His ears in these headphones?
Yeah, I guess so. Why?
Well, I don't know why I get the communal headphones. Yours are always your headphones and mine are always the guest.
Well, I'm always sitting here in front of the board controlling things.
Yeah, now I feel like my ears are itchy. I'm just joking.
Well, Elsa, it's a hermit show tonight.
What are the odds?
Not just any hermit show. It's a hermit show about my book, I've Never Minded the Loneliness.
How did you even book the time? Like, how did you get in? Like, for the right week?
Well, same. I paid people
off. Oh, okay.
This book is your fault, by the way.
What do you mean it's my fault?
You started all this hermit nonsense by buying me that first postcard of William Woodruff.
Oh, I had not realized that.
The first photo postcard? No, really, you did. And you said, he's kind of like a wild man.
And they are.
And you said, yeah, they are very much like wild men. And you sat him on my desk, and months went by, and when I finally looked up his story, I was blown away. And I thought, well, we'd done historical stuff on the podcast already by that time. Mm-hmm. We'd done circus stories and some true crime stuff, I think. I thought, well, let me try to do this story and see if people like it.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't know. I thought, well, we'll do one, and we'll never do another one if people don't like it. But people seem to really like it. And then they liked our hermit stories in general. We started doing more of them.
So what other occupations do you think we could bring in? Like,
I don't know. Lumberjacks, Allison. I think we could start doing lumberjack stories.
That's true. We have actually done.
Yeah.
We did the Jumping Frenchman episode.
Yeah. Yeah. And in a way, isn't
every episode with Chad a lumberjack story?
I was going to say every Flannel Man episode a lumberjack story.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're in charge of interviewing me tonight. For I Have Never Minded the Loneliness, Hermits and Their Stories. It's my most recent book. It's just published. It is available on Amazon. You can order it directly from us and get a signed copy, though. And there's links at strangefamiliars.com. There's links in the show notes and so forth. This is over 3 years of research, writing, and illustration. There are stories of, let's see, I should know this offhand, over 36 hermits I've written about in here. There's 37 chapters. Some chapters cover more than one hermit, but one chapter is a hermit miscellany. And it has a whole bunch of photos and stories of different hermits, and some of them. No story, because I didn't know who they were. 30-some biographies, mini biographies of hermits. Get to see a photo of almost everyone. There's a few hermits in here that I don't have photos for.
Because I think your inclusion of them in the book was largely drawn from the collection of photos you had amassed, right?
Yeah, that's how I narrowed down. So if you just look up hermits, 19th century hermits, There's tons of them.
Yeah, it seems like every community has a hermit.
Nearly. And they were reported on often because local papers, you know, they wanted human interest stories. And who's that guy who lives alone up on the mountain?
Yeah.
So there's tons and tons of hermits. And when I decided to write a book on hermits, so how am I going to narrow this down? Because they all have interesting stories. I mean, almost universally, they have interesting stories. And I thought, well, I had amassed this photo collection, starting with the photo you bought for me. And then I just started collecting hermit photos. Real photo postcards, stereo views, tintypes, cabinet cards, CDVs. And I amassed a pretty big collection. And then I thought, well, I'll write about the hermits who I have photos of. And that's how I'll narrow it down who I'm going to write about. That's how I got the hermits for the book, you know, from the photos, essentially, except for a snake charmer in there. I think we read his story on the podcast. Irving of Irvington. And I don't remember if that was a regular show or a patron show. And I don't know if he was even a real person. I think he was probably made up. But the story's so much fun. And I had there's another snake hunter in there. In fact, he's on the cover. The snake charmer went very well with the snake hunter, so I just put in there. There's no photo of him. There's a drawing of him from the old newspaper. There's no photo of one of the Blue Mountain hermits who we did a show on. There were two Blue Mountain hermits. They lived on Blue Mountain outside of Redding in Berks County at the same time. They had to have known each other. But
do all hermits know each other? Is that just a presumption?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't
like,
know.
It's not like they have like
conventions. You would think they would be aware of each other, though. You know, they're living on
why,
the same mountain.
If you're not aware of the rest of the world going by, why would you be aware that there's another guy that's just like you?
Yeah, maybe not. But in any case, there's a photo of one, but not the other. And the Gettysburg Hermit, I don't have a photo of. I looked and looked. I really want a photo of him. So you get my interpretation of the Gettysburg Hermit, which is based on a very basic newspaper sketch of him. And I kind of took that and expanded upon it. So you get my illustration of the Gettysburg Hermit, but no photo of him. But otherwise, it's filled with photos. You get to see the people I write about.
So I guess maybe we should start off with a definition, because I was thinking, like, specifically from a local history standpoint, there are people who might be considered hermits, but lived in, like, say, maybe a more urban situation. Like in York, there was a very famous African-American hermit.
Fascinating guy.
Yeah, Squire Braxton.
Who we will do his story one day on the show, for sure.
Yeah, he has a really fascinating story. But he lived in what they referred to as a shack in Penn Park.
Yeah.
That was, I don't think it was previously slave quarters because it would have been post that time in York. He lived in just a little homemade shack there, and then was a part of the community. He came in the early 1800s with a bunch of other freed people who were leaving the South. But because he lived in that, I guess what I'm saying is, like, would he be considered a hermit because he lived in a more urban
location? Yeah, I have
rural.
Most of the hermits in the book are rural, you know, but some of them were in pretty populated communities. There's a guy who lived on Far Rockaway Beach in Long Island, which, you know, was not as populated as it is now, but it was still a tourist place at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, he became a tourist attraction. And he, very much like Squire Braxton, they called him Charlie. And then there was a Charlie the Hermit who may or may not have died. And I think was replaced by this other guy. And they just started calling him Charlie too.
Yeah, it becomes like, because
there's a hermit there. The hermit before was Charlie. I will just call him Charlie too. Or maybe some people didn't know there was two different ones.
Yeah, because there was a lady in the area who told us about a guy named Squire Braxton who lived in that park when she was a kid. And it's impossible.
It's absolutely impossible.
He would have he would have had to have been 160 years old.
Right. So somebody else moved in there and they just started calling
him the same name. Yeah.
So the community at Far Rockaway actually started taking care of him because he was such a tourist attraction. He was good for business because people would come there And while they're there doing the touristy things, they could also see a real hermit, you know? So
yeah, I mean, I guess
the community started taking care of him and they bought him like a wood stove. At one point, they built him a new cabin when his got too rough. They would feed him, like the local bakers and stuff would bring him bread and so forth. So he was, you know, definitely part of the community, but he lived alone.
So it's not so much like the location so much as the way of life.
I think so. I think so. And sometimes it's self-defined and sometimes it's newspaper defined, you know?
Yeah. And it seems to be, there is a real dichotomy between these sort of like celebrity hermits or people who had like a real presence within the community as like an eccentric person mm-hmm. versus people who really just wanted to be left alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess my first question would be, who is your favorite of the ones who just wanted to be left alone? And who is your favorite of the celebrity hermits? So
John Stink, of the ones who wanted to be left alone. And again, we did an episode on John Stink. Hotamoe was his Osage name. And, you know, the story goes with him, if people don't remember that he died and came back to life.
Multiple times.
As many as three times. Okay, and there's 15 or 20 different accounts of how he died in the book that I collected.
Yeah, so there are people that were witnesses to his supposed death.
Supposedly, you know, and how much is legend and how much is fact?
And how was he supposed to have died in some of these times?
Well, let's see. Starting in 1906, the Lawton News Republican reported that he was afflicted with some sort of disease and was rapidly emaciated. His friends declared that he could not live. He was pronounced dead, buried in a shallow grave. Also in 1906, the Muskogee Daily Phoenix and Times Democrat gave no name to the illness, but reported that he was buried for dead. But before the medicine man had completed his ceremonies, John sat up, rubbed his eyes, and spoke. By the way, most of these accounts are in white newspapers, so I don't know how much of the Osage actual burial practices and beliefs mm-hmm. are real that they're reporting on, but this is what they reported. Moving on, the Fort Worth Register in 1906 reported that he had pneumonia and entered a comatose state. It was assumed he was dead. He was interred in an old burial ground not far from Pawhuska, Oklahoma, but awoke and returned to the settlement not long after the funeral party. In 1907, the Coffeeville Daily Journal reported that he had been dead for 3 days before he returned. They didn't say how he died. It was decided that that the dead should stay dead and that an evil spirit had reanimated his corpse. The Ponca City Daily Courier reported in 1908 that he had apparently died three different times during the last 3 years. They said he was buried in a stone house. It's unclear if they meant he was buried each time he supposedly died mm-hmm. or not. In 1914, the Daily Ardmoreite said he was found drunk by the roadside many years ago from, you know, that's what they said in 1914, and presumed dead. The Wichita Beacon in 1914 stated that his apparent death was at the hands of a savage beating from the Osage law officers. The Wichita Eagle reported in 1919 that a fever had put him in a comatose state, and he was pronounced dead by tribal medicine men. This is a quote. He was buried on one of the Indian burial racks, but recovered sufficiently to disentangle himself from the shroud. He found himself an outcast from the tribe, shunned and hooted at. In 1919, the Morning Tulsa Daily World stated that he'd been a chieftain and led his warriors in a battle with the Creeks. He was wounded and stunned and was buried according to custom beneath a pile of rocks, having been judged dead. 3 days later, being a man of great strength, he regained consciousness, threw off his rocky grave, and returned to the tribe.
That's almost more than three times, isn't it? I mean, the story's enough of a change where
it goes on from there. In 1926, NEA service writer Bruce Catton noted that it was white mule or moonshine whiskey which left him in a comatose state. He could not be revived, was pronounced dead by a caucus of elders. A funeral was organized. He was carried to a barren hill, placed in a sitting position in the lee of a huge rock, gently covered with smaller stones, brush, and the like. The following morning, he awoke with a throbbing hangover, extricated himself from the rock burial, and headed home. In 1932, the Daily Oklahoman reported that he had contracted tuberculosis in the 1890s. His friends found him cold and stiff, thought him dead, placed him on a hillside with his shield. This is another quote. Quote, with his shield and medicine mysteries under his head and bell and trophies at his side. They covered him with rocks, but he woke up from this false death, exhumed himself, returned to the world of the living. The Kansas Star in 1938 stated it was smallpox, which left him in a death-like coma. Assuming he had passed, his friends and relatives carried him to the woods and returned to the village. Author Kenneth Jump wrote a biography called The Legend of John Stink. He said that the Sisters of Loretto Catholic School, he had established a campsite near the Sisters of Loretto Catholic School, and he was found apparently frozen to death at this camp. Jump asserts that it was likely that the hermit buried himself in the snow to try to preserve as much heat as he could when his shelter proved inadequate protection from the frigid temperatures, and probably describing the same incident, the Pawhuska Guide website notes that he was found in a snowbank, unconscious, by nuns from the Sisters of Loretto Catholic School. He was thought to have frozen to death, but revived a short time later. So there's all these different stories about his death, but what's constant is pretty much when he comes back. He returns from the dead, and he's met with revulsion from his people because they said the dead are meant to stay dead. So stumbling back to the village, dazed and haggard, Hotemoe states, I'm alive. No, came the reply from his people. John Stink. So they kind of renamed him. This is the legend. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know if this is true or not. The newspapers from that time assert that the Osage looked upon John Stink as an evil spirit, and he was outcast from the community. I don't know how much of that is true. But there is an oil strike in the early 1900s on Osage land. And at that time, they became per capita the richest people in the world, including John Stink. He got a share of this money. John Stink could have lived in a mansion if he wanted to. He chose to live outside. He wanted to live outside. They built him a house. And he said, no, it makes me sick to live inside. So he wanted to live outside. He lived outside with his pack of dogs. And that's just, you know, kind of the way he wanted to live.
And how did he die, like, the last time?
So he died... finally,
yeah,
for sure, of pneumonia. He had fallen and broken his leg. Mm-hmm. He was 75 years old, and he developed pneumonia and died. And he was buried with his cigar in one hand and his rosary in the other. And he's in the mausoleum in Pawhuska, which only the wealthiest people are buried in that mausoleum.
Oh, wow.
So he had a Catholic ceremony, and then he had a Osage ceremony for his funeral. His dogs were at his coffin, like sitting there at his coffin.
Oh.
He was a very imposing looking man. He was about 6 feet tall and he wore a knife on his belt. Very, very imposing looking. But he was a kind man. And he gave money to every local church, not just the Catholic churches. Mm-hmm. He gave money to every local church. He gave a lot of money to the Osage American Legion Hut. He helped establish that. And he gave money to help Osage girls go to private school, you know, pay their tuition outright. So generous guy. Good for the community, just like to be alone, I think.
Mm-hmm. Or at least just wanted to be outside.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there's some sadness with him. There was an incident where there was a rabies outbreak in Pawhuska, and there's actually a newspaper article, and it states, all dogs must be muzzled except for John Stink's dogs. He was so well-known, and his dogs were so well-trained, that they said, all dogs except his. His can go without muzzle. But then there's a story later on where a marshal shoots and kills his dogs. And I really think that this guy knew who John Stink was.
Yeah, yeah,
everybody deliberately. Everybody knew who he was. And he said, oh, they were attacking him. And he shot and killed all his dogs. And John Stink leaves Pawhuska and says, I'll never come back to this town. And doesn't, except for one time that I could find. He did go back one time, but for the rest of his life, pretty much he stayed outside of town. From that point. So it's, you know, kind of sad. But he did get more dogs than he was known. Any dog that found its way to his door had a home. So he just became my favorite. I just love that story. I love the, you know, the living ghost is such a great name, you know. He's definitely somebody who wanted to be by himself and probably didn't want the celebrity. I have several photos of him. Many of them are candid shots of him on the streets of Pawhuska before he left.
Mm-hmm. Where he might not have known that he was having his photo taken.
I don't think he did. Some of them, he appears to be asleep. Mm-hmm. Some of them, he's just kind of sitting there. Some of them, he's standing there. I think people were just snapping his photo and putting them on postcards. others later on. He purchased property and he had a tall barbed wire fence. And it's him standing at the barbed wire fence. The photo, a lot of the photos are, you know, so it's kind of imposing there, you know, this stay off my land kind of vibe.
But, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, seemed like he's a good guy. And I just, such a fascinating story. Could have built himself a mansion, you know, and he just wanted to live outside.
It is fascinating, too, that while there is this sort of like stereotype of like what a hermit looks like, and certainly a lot of people do fit that stereotype in the book.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
But there are people of every race and gender.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just the grizzled old white guy with the beard, right?
No.
There are young hermits. There are female hermits.
I didn't find too many women hermits.
Mm-hmm.
But I did find Jenny Johanica, and she was known as the Hermit of Happy Hollow. She was in Indiana. And she's the one, I may have the only existing photo of her.
It's a cyanotype, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So she wore wooden shoes. She was Dutch. And you can actually see them in the cyanotype. It's hard to reproduce that in the book. Some of the photos reproduce better than others. But in the cyanotype, you can actually just see the wooden shoes under her dress on the back.
What area of Indiana is this? Is it close to...
It's not too close to where I was.
Oh, okay. It's not close to Jennings.
But there's a park there now, and they have a sign up that, you know, that said, you know, the Hermit of Happy Hollow lived here, and they have a drawing of her on the sign. And I don't even know. The drawing doesn't look like my photo.
Mm.
I don't know if they even knew what she looked like, you know? I really think it might be the only photo. Probably a...
Was it identified when you bought it?
Yeah, it's written on the back.
Oh, so it's like in someone of the period.
It's like Mademoiselle Johanica, and it's spelled with a Y, and everywhere else it's spelled with a J. So it's someone phonetically spelling her name, and it gives her dog's name as well. She has her dog there. And I think it says Hermit of Happy. I think it's just Hermit or something like that. But she was known as the Hermit Queen of Happy Hollow.
That's another thing I think is interesting, is that these are people that, while they might not necessarily vibe with people, they love animals. Like, there's so many of them. Like, who is it that has the little cat Toby?
Oh, that was John Smith, who we did on a patron show. Actually, I devoted two patron shows.
Because you went on a hermit trip.
Yes.
A hermit research trip, and so you got to see where he was buried.
Yes, he had a cave, which he called Irving Castle. So for those who weren't patrons or aren't patrons and didn't hear it, or maybe for patrons who forgot, John Smith was an ornamental hermit. So from about the 1600s through the 1800s, lords and ladies, you know, royal people in England, Scotland, and France, it was very much in fashion for you to have a hermit on your property. So they would hire guys to be hermits, essentially. Mm-hmm. They would have a contract. Sometimes
like, don't cut your hair.
Yeah, these contracts is like, you cannot cut your hair. You cannot, you know, cut your beard. Some of them, you couldn't cut your fingernails.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted them to be kind of religious hermits. So they would say, you know, you have to be pious and you have to, they would have these, and they would sign these contracts for a length of time, you know, some 6 months, a year, maybe more. So John Smith was an ornamental hermit for several lords and ladies throughout Scotland, and ends up coming to America, finding this cave, and he calls it Irving Castle, which I love, because now he's become
the lord of the manor.
Now he has a castle,
and
it's a modest cave. It's not a very big cave at all. It's a modest cave that he built a structure on the front of, and he gets to live his life. And you were asking me, like, you know, versus the celebrity. He's kind of more of the celebrities. That once they found him, he had visitors every weekend. And he made a kind of a cottage industry out of selling photos of himself. We have a few photos of him that he signed on the back and wrote notes about, you know, what was on there. So he would sell these stereo view photos of himself, and he would sell his biography. He wrote his biography and he would sell it to people when they were there.
Those are not very different, really, from what a lot of circus people did.
Very similar. Very similar. And, of course, English Jack, he was a circus performer before he became a hermit. And we did him on the show, too. he did something in the circus where he would eat frogs and snakes and so forth, and he would still do that as a hermit. You could pay him, I think it was 50 cents and he'd eat a frog, but he wanted $5 to eat a snake.
I mean, it's really a supply and demand and risk.
And there's someone wrote sort of like an epic poem called The Story of Jack, which sort of tells this fantastical story that is almost certainly more lie than truth, because he's like in every war. He's in this shipwreck that's a ship that we could not find, no ship under that name anywhere. He's on a shipwreck on a desert island for like a year or something. He's the only one who survives.
Of course.
Like, yeah, of this whole crew. One by one, they die off, including the last one dies off on the ship back to England. So he's the only one left that could possibly tell the story.
Yeah.
So there's definitely some exaggeration going on in his story. He was a circus showman. And the guy, we'll probably read the story in a bit of Left-Handed Charlie. He claimed to be a circus performer anyway.
Ironically, right-handed.
No. He was left-handed. He was left-handed. And my illustration of Left-Handed Charlie, I will give this little bit away. I had drawn him. He was a fiddle player.
Yeah.
He was supposedly a very, very good fiddle player. And I had drawn a fiddle player playing right-handed.
Uh-huh.
So I had to flip it in Photoshop. So it's a mirror image. So he is playing left-handed in the book, but it's only because my original photo shows him, my original illustration shows him playing right-handed. I made a mistake when I drew it.
Shame.
I know. Left-Handed Charlie was a bit of a tall tale teller, which we will hear about. He's caught in a lie by an American president. Oh, well, future American president.
Really?
Yeah.
But we were talking about their animals.
Yes. So John Smith had his cat Toby, which he wrote a poem to, which I include the poem in the book.
And he's buried with him, right?
He loved this cat. He had a tombstone made for this cat, which was originally outside his cave, and it said Toby. When he died, they moved the cat's tombstone to be with his headstone. So he's in the Irving Center Cemetery in Irving, there in Irving, Massachusetts. I went and saw his grave, and Toby's stone is right there next to his.
Oh, in the ground, like,
yeah, it's just a little stone. It says Toby, and his actually says Hermit on it. It says the Hermit on it. It says John Smith the Hermit. There's a photo of me by his grave in the book. So he had his cat Toby. English Jack kept several animals, including he tried to keep a bear, but it didn't work out well. He said he ended up eating the bear because it just became too aggressive. Yeah. So Mason Augustus Walton, he was the Gloucester hermit from Massachusetts, and he had tuberculosis. And the doctor said, they kind of said, your last hope is to go off to sea and get, they thought the salt air would help.
Yeah.
He was on the way to do that. And he just kind of made a left turn into the forest there and
saved a million people from getting tuberculosis.
Well, he slept out in the air, and it was kind of reported on as like, it's kind of this miraculous cure that, because he had this like really bad case of TB, and he ends up, he says, curing it from the natural air. It was a combination, he said, of the sea air and the clean forest air.
Oh, cured him.
But he kept a number of pets. He published a book called A Hermit's Wild Friends, 18 Years in the Woods. They said the animals were kind of enchanted with him. The chickadees would come out and land on his fingers. He could call them from the woods. Sparrows, snowbirds, and thrushes would visit his house. He had two pet squirrels named Tiny and Bismarck. They had full run of his cabin. But he had a raccoon, which he named Satan.
Wow.
This raccoon was so aggressive that there's a story of a lion tamer from a circus happened to come by and visit him. And he had this raccoon chained up by a tree. And this lion tamer says, well, I can tame, like, that's nothing. I tame lions.
Yeah, yeah.
And apparently this raccoon attacked him and he just had no part with it. That's why he called his pet raccoon Satan. It was pretty aggressive and mean. So I think I ran into him in Hex Hollow.
You know what I love about so many of the pictures is because these people didn't have any access to like sort of the larger world, they're frequently wearing clothing from like 20, things that were fashionable 20, 30, 40 years previous what would have been, you know, if you're trying to date something based on the way someone's dressed, they're in another time.
So he's living in Gloucester Forest, and Samuel Sawyer, a Massachusetts philanthropist, dies in 1899, and in his will, he leaves 600 acres around this to be used as a nature preserve, and it's renamed Ravenswood Park. He was living there at the time, and he was allowed to remain living in the park for the rest of, you know, as long as he was able. He became the Hermit of Ravenswood Park then. There's a sign there today that around where his cabin was. It says, you know, a hermit lived here. So he ended up dying in 1917. He was 78 years old.
Probably the Spanish flu.
And no one had seen him for a while. And they went to check on him. And they found him kind of dazed and cold in his cabin. He was taken to the Alms Health Hospital, diagnosed with pneumonia. And he died on May 21st of 1917. So his body was then taken to Maine, where his wife was buried. Mm-hmm. His wife died long before him. And his cabin stood until 1948 there in the park. It was finally destroyed by fire. And there's a plaque there today.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. Carvana makes car buying easy. Isn't that right, hun? Dax? Dax?
Sorry, did you know about this 7-day money-back guarantee?
A week to evaluate seat comfiness, you say?
A week of terrain tests? Yeah, I can test the brake pad resistance at variable speeds.
Make sure all the kids' stuff fits nicely.
Make sure our stuff fits nicely.
Oh, the...
Right. Still need to buy the car. Getting ahead of ourselves here.
Buy your car with Carvana today.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at freestylelibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
So do you find that most hermits meet their end not being able to live on in their enclosures?
Like, yeah, eventually.
Like it's just too tough to live outside.
Eventually somebody hasn't heard from them for a while. They go to check on them. It's usually when they're older and they just can't make it anymore. Mm-hmm. And they're taken to the almshouse or they're taken to, you know, a hospital.
Or a neighbor, like a kindly neighbor takes them in or something.
Some of them die with neighbors and so forth. It's just after a point you can't do it. You know, you can't live on your own. I mean, for most people, you know.
Yeah, whether you're in a house or in a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
The cover star, which was a last-minute change, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
There's the fellow on the back cover with the long beard. Mm-hmm. His name is Bill Smith, by the way. Not related to John Smith. Mm-hmm. He was known as the giant hermit of the Adirondacks. He was very tall. His beard...
Was he a circus performer?
He was... exhibited in New York. And in fact, that's probably what that photo's from.
Yeah.
That photo was taken in New York.
Is it an Eisenman photo?
It's not.
Oh.
No. It is, hold on, I'll tell you.
Cerrone?
Obermüller and Kern.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they're like one of the top three circus performers, or circus photographers.
Yeah, so he definitely was on exhibit. His beard was 8 feet long. He could stand on his beard when he stood up. His mustache, they said he could hold either end of his mustache out.
Like Theda Bara.
at length in his arms. And he said he could not account for why his hair grew that way. He's like, my dad didn't have crazy hair. My mom didn't have crazy hair, you know. So he said, I always cut my own hair. He said, I wasn't any good at it. And one day I just decided to stop. So he just grew his hair.
Wow.
Like quite a few of these guys, his death was falsely reported, and he actually read about it when he was on exhibit in New York. He read that he had died. But he was originally going to be the cover model. He's kind of a handsome guy for, you know, hermit-wise.
Yeah, because like if you took off the beard and you took off the white hair, he looks much younger.
Yeah, and he's in a nice suit. And up until the last minute, when we both decided that Brusher Mills should be on the cover. He was a snake catcher from England, and he would catch adders, which are venomous.
Mm-hmm. Is it like one of the only venomous snakes in...
I think it is the only venomous.
In the UK.
Yeah. And he literally sold snake oil, which mm-hmm. he would make by boiling the adder fat down. And he said that was a cure for the bite. Golf courses would hire him to get the adders off the golf course and so forth. But besides being the wonderful cover model, and there's lots of pictures of him, he was thought to be for a long time. And now he's not. Mm-hmm. They've discovered who is this the person on the cover of this. But for a long time, he was thought to be the person on the cover of Led Zeppelin 4. It's the guy kind of bending over with the sticks on his back, mm-hmm. I think. And I think it was just recently, in the past 2 years or so, they figured out who that is on the cover. And
it was based on some, was it like the library or something had the, it was something regional where there was a tip from someone's album or something and they figured out who he was.
It's not Brusher Mills, but for years they thought it was. And the interesting thing about that, if you have the album of that mm-hmm. and you open up the gatefold, there's the hermit.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the tarot card hermit.
The tarot card hermit that, you know, you've seen on a million Led Zeppelin t-shirts. Mm-hmm. That's the gatefold. So he had the hermit on the inside cover and, you know, it ended up not being Brusher Mills, but mm-hmm. I thought it was pretty neat.
Ironically, at a time when everyone in the world knew who they were and they had the least chance for being hermits themselves. That's the dream, though, right? Who doesn't want a little hovel just to, like, where you can be left alone? I mean, is that not, like, what, you know, as kids, maybe that's not so popular now, but when we were kids, like, fort building, or, like, just, like, yeah. or even just, like, blanket forts, or, like, my sister and I used to make blanket forts, and, like, just to have one little place that was your own is it's not that far removed from everyone's imagination.
So do you want to hear the story of Left-Handed Charlie?
Well, yeah.
He's the one that was called out by future President Theodore Roosevelt, caught him in a lie.
Oh.
He's Left-Handed Charlie. He lived around, well, he actually lived for a time on Chautauqua Lake in New York.
Oh, okay.
And I would just read the chapter of my book on Left-Handed Charlie. In the wondrous strange lives of our hermit, it is often difficult to parse braggadocious exaggeration on the hermit's part from popular legend and from truth. Oftentimes, I think the hermits just let the stories be told about them. If people wanted to think they were war heroes or had an otherwise storied past, why not? Where's the real harm? In other cases, I think the hermits might never have known the tales that were told about them. Of course, sometimes hermits would make up stories about themselves. In the case of English Jack, I simply can't imagine the adventures documented in the rather epic poem The Story of Jack were all true. The hermit of Chautauqua Lake, New York, Charles E. Cowden, also known as Left-Handed Charlie, seems to have been caught in the act of telling falsehoods by none other than a future president of the United States. Charlie claimed to have been a performer with the Dan Rice Circus, a drummer boy in the Civil War, a cowboy in the Old West, a sailor, and a soldier. Circus performers often use stage names, so it's certainly possible that Charlie worked under an alias, but a search of the Circus Historical Society's Olympians of the Sawdust Circle performer database yields no one by the name of Charles Cowden. There was, however, another performer who used the stage name Left-Handed Charlie. His name was C.A. Damon of Buffalo, New York. Damon was a sharpshooter and gave thrilling performances in theaters and fairs across the country. One of Damon's tricks was to shoot the ashen tip off of a cigar while someone was smoking. It is possible that someone along the way mistook Damon for Charlie Cowden, and the performances were attributed to the hermit. As to Cowden's claims of being a drummer boy, he was supposed to have been with the 112th New York Infantry, which would make sense as they were known as the Chautauqua Regiment, but searching records of the regiment turns up no one named Cowden. Seeing as his own military records indicate that he was in the Navy during the Civil War, and the Navy did not employ drummer boys, we can conclude with some degree of certainty that Cowden was not a drummer boy. It was Left-Handed Charlie's claims of being a cowboy which got him caught telling lies, however. When Theodore Roosevelt, then governor of New York, came to hear the hermit's stories in the late 1890s, the Forest Republican reported on June 14, 1899. There's probably not a small boy in the state who does not know of the governor's life in the West and of his prowess as a hunter and skill as a cowboy. It was natural that the boys of Chautauqua should be greatly elated at the coming of the hero over the summer in question, and that they should lug him off to see one left-handed Charlie, another hero of theirs, who lived in a houseboat on the lake and spent most of his time telling thrilling tales of his career in the far West. Governor Roosevelt quickly turned the conversation to the West and very soon discovered that left-handed Charlie was a fraud. So Charlie didn't let the facts get in the way of a good story, especially when that story was about himself. Lorraine C. Smith noted in an online article about Charlie entitled The Hermit of Chautauqua Lake, "Charlie would spin yarns with the best of them, sometimes accounting for at least 150 years of living instead of his probably 50 or 60. It was said that Charlie never forgot the date of his birth, June 9, 1843, for it was tattooed on his arm. Charlie Cowden was married to a woman named Jane Nee White. They had at least three children, Ida May, born in 1869, Clara, born in 1870, and a son, Willie, who was born in 1874. Records state that Willie was born crippled, and Jane died in 1874. One wonders if it was a result of childbirth complications. Charlie's children were eventually sent to the House for the Friendless, an orphanage in Erie, Pennsylvania. However, in 1870, Charlie and his family lived in Sherman, New York. Later, he was known to live in Jamestown, New York. Here, he was known about town for his clog dancing. In one clog dancing contest at the headquarters saloon, he beat a famous dancer named Frankie and earned himself a large gold medal as a prize. Charles Cowden was living as a hermit around Chautauqua Lake at least as early as 1892. He first lived on a small island in the middle of Pendergrass Creek. He built there a kind of tent made of cloth draped over a tripod and hidden from sight by branches and brush. After this, Charlie obtained a sailboat, on top of which he built an 8-foot by 12-foot cabin. Charlie used this boat to take people on fishing outings and tours of Chautauqua Lake. His last residence at Chautauqua Lake was a rough cabin near Whitney's Bay. Charlie wore his hair long with a bushy mustache. Lorraine C. Smith wrote that he was known to dress in a, quote, highly picturesque fashion. Though it is doubtful Charlie was of Native American heritage, sometimes he donned a feathered headdress, took up a tomahawk, bow and arrow, and demonstrated his skills with the weapons. He would often put on what was deemed a, quote, Indian act for Chautauqua Lake tourists. It was with the fiddle, however, that Charlie was particularly talented. It was said that he carried his fiddle on all of his journeys and that the instrument had been through the War of 1812 when it belonged to his father. With the bow in his left hand, Charlie could make the fiddle sound like a banjo, a piano, and several other instruments. He said that he learned to make the fiddle imitate these other instruments because he could not own them all. Charlie was always ready to play fiddle for the neighborhood dances. Left-handed Charlie was also a skilled whittler. With his two sharp jackknives, he carved what one reporter for the Olean Democrat termed curious things. He was known to carve folding fans from a single piece of pine wood. When the cold New York winter set in, Charlie often went to live temporarily with nearby families. He would play fiddle or tell stories to entertain his hosts through the cold winter nights. When Charlie felt that he had worn out his welcome, he would wander away to visit another family, leaving one of his carved fans behind for the lady of the house. If Charlie couldn't find a local family with which he could overwinter, he went to the county farm in DeWittville, New York. When Charlie got older, he moved to Erie. For 2 years, he resided at the Soldiers and Sailors Home. He died on July 15, 1908, at his daughter Ida's home in Harbor Creek, Pennsylvania. He's buried in Northeast Cemetery in the town of Northeast, Pennsylvania.
So not all the hermits were totally without family either.
Yeah, yeah, he had family. And one wonders, you know, did he abandon his children or did he have PTSD or something, you know, from the war? Did he?
Yeah, there seemed to be a fair amount of Civil War vets in here.
Yeah. And you wonder if that played into it.
Wouldn't need to be away from people.
They wouldn't have diagnosed it back then. It wasn't even, I mean, they started talking about it, what was shell shock and, or battle fatigue, I guess, right?
Yeah, battle fatigue, shell shock. Yeah. It just keeps changing names.
Yeah. So, and, you know, what kind of mental health treatment was there?
Alcoholism, I think.
Yeah. So I think a lot of these guys were, you know, heading off because of PTSD, you know. There's another Chautauqua Lake Hermit that preceded him. I might as well read this one too.
Was the lake that big? Well, now I'm back to your question.
He preceded left-handed Charlotte, so he was before him. And this guy's interesting. This guy actually turns up in UFO books.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Before left-handed Charlie made the area his home, another curious hermit, bearing the honorific title of Commodore Downs, lived in a little hut by Chautauqua Lake. Truman Downs first came to the area in the 1850s. He made his living by fishing, keeping to the most remote areas of the lake. No one knew where Downs had come from, however, and it was noted that the hermit must have been well-educated, for he showed what the Jamestown Journal noted to be a, quote, unexpected familiarity with the writings of the best poets and most famous authors. Downs was likewise said to have good manners and cultivated speech. The United States Census of 1860 lists Truman Downs' age at the time as 62. His occupation was fisherman, and his birthplace was given as New York. When asked about his origins, however, Commodore Downs claimed the planet Mars as his birthplace. Some accounts state that he also gave Venus and Jupiter as his planets of origin. Having been ejected from the red planet, Downs said he slid down a rainbow, landing upon the Earth. Initially, the alien found it difficult to obtain nourishment, as his otherworldly diet consisted of ethereal air and electric fluid. Luckily, he found whiskey to be an adequate earthly substitute for the Martian meals. Downs had canines as his only companions. At the death of one of his dogs named Pompey, the hermit was said to have performed, quote, strange mortuary ceremonies, at which he showed signs of deep mourning for his pet. A stereo view photograph taken toward the end of Downs' life notes on the reverse that the hermit was accompanied in the image by his dog Cato. Returning to the Jamestown Journal, Downs was described as a queer, ungainly figure with a shambling gait, tattered garb, and a face furrowed by time and darkened by exposure. Though Downs took credit for pointing out a suitable location in the area for a local group of Methodists to hold their camp meetings, he generally avoided crowds and those areas of Chautauqua Lake frequented by tourists. Truman Downs was admitted to the Chautauqua County Almshouse and Asylum on August 27, 1880. He died on July 20, 1881. Norman Carlson, writing in the Chautauqua Genealogist, found a note regarding Downs' town or place of origin in the almshouse records, Jupiter. As Carlson explains, there has never been a place in New York named Jupiter. Assuming Commodore Downs wasn't claiming Jupiter, Florida as his home, it seems that he was sticking to his assertion of interplanetary travel until his last days. Strange Familiars is brought to you by our patrons. We could not make the show without them. Thank you, patrons. Thank you so much for everything you do. Thank you for your support. If you like what we do at Strange Familiars, and you'd like to help us make the show and get extra content besides, you can become a patron at Patreon. It's patreon.com/strangefamiliars. All of our patrons get commercial-free versions of the weekly shows, plus extra episodes. We do at least one full extra episode for our patrons every month. Sometimes we do more. Our Patreon patrons will also be able to participate in an upcoming paranormal experiment, which we will be hopefully detailing in February and get started as soon as possible after that with it. Another reason to become a patron at Patreon, patreon.com/strangefamiliars. There's also an option at Apple Podcasts. It's called Patron of the Strange there. And our Apple Podcast subscribers get the commercial shows weekly as well as the extra shows monthly. And thank you, patrons, no matter where you're signed up. It's a great help. And as I said, we could not make Strange Familiars without your help. There are photos of, like I said, almost every hermit in there. Almost, so you get to see Truman Downs, you get to see left-handed Charlie. I found photos of left-handed Charlie. Some of them are on postcards, but some of them were private photos I found. There was a preacher that had, for some reason, had gone up there and taken photos of him.
Mm.
And I was able to find them in somewhere. I don't know, somewhere I found them. That's the thing. I don't know where I get half the stuff anymore. You know, the collection expanded quickly. mm-hmm. over the course of my hermit collecting. So the most popular hermit in the book is probably the old leather man. And we did a show on him, but it was a patron show.
And that was pretty early too, wasn't it?
I think so. I think it was one of the earlier hermit shows mm-hmm. we did. And to this day, I'll get emails maybe once a month with somebody saying, you ought to cover the old leather man. Mm-hmm. You ought to do a show on the old leather man. We've already done a show on the old leather man. But we can go over him again. Like I said, he's very, very popular. And the thing that's interesting about him is he's a true mystery. And there's not many of those. Even among these hermits, we were able to find
a lot of information. Most of the people. I think, and that might be due to the fact that a lot of people did end up in almshouses. And mm-hmm. so the records were probably more complete than they would have been in any other capacity.
The Leather Man, for those who don't know, he was an itinerant hermit. So he didn't stay in one place. He moved around and he did this circuit through New York and Connecticut.
And it was so regular that people would sort of time of year.
Every 34 days, he would complete this circuit. So farmers would plant their crops by, you know, according to when he showed up. He was that regular. He wore a leather suit that he made for himself. It was like sewn together from tops of old leather boots and stuff. Mm-hmm. It was a patchwork leather suit. It weighed over 60 pounds, the suit. Summer and winter, he would make this circuit again and again, wearing this heavy leather suit. It had to be cold in the winter, hot in the summer, incredibly uncomfortable. He made his own boots with wooden soles. So he would walk, oh my gosh, at least 10 miles a day. I think it might have been 20 miles a day. It was 10 miles a day with these wooden soled boots that didn't, oof. No flexibility in them. And he just did it constantly, again and again. And he showed up I think it was in the 1860s, he first shows up. 1858. He just seemed to appear one day. And nobody really knew where he came from. When he spoke, and he spoke very little, he had a French accent, but he spoke some English. That's pretty much all they knew about him. He would stop. Some people would give him food. He'd never begged, but he would stop at their houses again. Like he would kind of remember
that they. Oh, this person gave me a piece of pie, so I'll stop here.
Yeah, but he never wanted to be a nuisance. Mm-hmm. He was kind. He was kind to children. There are stories about kids who would eat their lunch with him. He never spoke to them, mm-hmm. but he was very kind, you know, just sat there quietly and they ate with the children. In the 1880s, New England newspapers published a story by W.A. Salson that was entitled Mystery Solved, which claimed to tell the true life story of the Leather Man. And this story goes that his name was Jules Bourgelet. He came from France and he had been engaged to the daughter of a leather merchant. And this leather merchant had trusted him to make investments and run his business. And, mm-hmm. and he made bad investments and lost a bunch of money. And the leather market collapsed. And for shame, you know, mm-hmm. and he wouldn't let him marry his daughter anymore. He was so mad at him. And in distress, he kind of loses his mind and goes to America and lives as this itinerant hermit. How you're able to make your way from France to America.
Yeah, it's curious.
But that's so the story goes. And this was reported in newspapers as his life story until the 1980s. Mm-hmm. Like from that time until the 1980s, his old tombstone used to actually say Jules Bourgelet on it. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't his name. It was a completely fictional story. Completely like made up wholesale.
Every part of it. The name, wasn't based on anything.
Everything was completely made up. What we do know about him is that he did have a French accent. He spoke French. He could have been French Canadian. He could have walked down from Canada.
Yeah, maybe just looking for work or something.
Or anything.
For any reason. Yeah.
He developed cancer. You can see in some pictures his lips swollen. Mm-hmm. It's very tragic. They said he would put a piece of leather over his lip and drink coffee and tea and soup and stuff because it, you know, would hurt him so bad. So he would sort of protect the lip with a piece of leather. And he died in Sing Sing, New York. They found his body in one of the caves he lived in. So he lived in a series of caves. He died March 20th, 1889 from cancer, obviously. And they've just found him in one of the caves he stayed in. So he mm-hmm. stayed in lean-to shelters and caves kind of dotted around Connecticut and New York. But we have in The Leather Man a true mystery. We don't know his name. We don't know how he got here.
Was there something about him when he died having a French Bible on, a Catholic Bible?
He had a prayer book and a scapular on.
Oh, okay.
So we know he was Catholic. That much we know. Beyond that.
And even the part about him being French, it was based entirely on what someone thought his accent sounded like.
Well, I believe they said he spoke French.
Oh, okay.
You know, I think the prayer book was in French, too, that he had.
The French-Canadian thing actually probably makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. 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 So among the Leatherman's possession were found a French prayer book, and he was wearing a scapular. When he was offered meat on Fridays, he would turn it down. So he's obviously Catholic. Beyond that, we don't know anything about him. And they tried to exhume him, I want to say about a decade ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to get his DNA. And maybe we can see who this guy is. His body had completely returned to the earth. There was nothing left. They found some, like, I think 3 or 4 coffin nails in his grave, and that's it. They reburied those and gave him a new tombstone, and his new tombstone just says the old Leatherman.
Oh.
Because that was a false name, and a false story attributed to his life. So a real rarity to have a true mystery.
Someone who really just kind of left whatever life they were leading and just popped up somewhere new.
Doesn't appear in the census. He's just a complete mystery. And even, we're talking about people from the 1800s, but we were able to find census records. Sometimes you found the ship records if they immigrated.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
We found which ship they came in. If they became naturalized citizens, you were able to find the records on that. But on the Leatherman, there's just nothing.
He's such an unusual look to him, too. He's just like a...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he looks like he's a big, heavy guy, but it's just the suit.
Yeah.
It's just that leather suit that's hanging on him. There are photos of him. I think there's known images of him, like maybe 8 to 10 of them or something like that. Known images of him. They're pretty expensive when you can find them.
Mm-hmm.
Cabinet card images, photographers. Some of them, he knew he was being photographed. Others, he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of were able to get pictures of him. I think one of them, they said he was standing behind a wash line and the cameraman was on the other side and they pulled the clothes aside and snapped a picture real quick. But they would sell pictures of him. He was such a curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
These photographers would sell pictures of him. When you can find them, they're expensive. I don't own one of the... I own a postcard, which was taken from the original picture, a photo postcard, and a photo of a painting that was made of him. When you can find pictures of him, they're pretty expensive. And often you do see him with a swollen lip, which is pretty sad. Yeah. He was a true, true mystery. Once again, the book is I Have Never Minded the Loneliness. It's my latest book. Hermits and Their Stories, full of photographs. It's full of illustrations. People have asked about an ebook. When I had my other books turned into ebooks, basically they took out the illustrations. The people, I don't know how to make an ebook. The,
mm-hmm.
the people who made the ebooks for me. So they don't work. They don't work in the ebook format.
Mm-hmm.
This book is so heavy with illustrations and photographs that it doesn't make a lot of sense to me to make an ebook of it.
Yeah.
It really belongs together, the illustrations mm-hmm. and the photos and the stories. Unless someone can make an ebook.
Yeah, that has all those things
that has, that keeps those things in it. It may not be an ebook.
Mm-hmm.
I will do an audiobook at some point. I'm working out ways to do audiobooks of all my books, and I'll probably just sell them on Bandcamp myself because why not? Audible has pretty strict rules about the audio and so forth, and if I do them on Bandcamp, I can do them my way.
Yeah, yeah.
So I Have Never Minded the Loneliness, Hermits and Their Stories. It is available on Amazon. It's available at your local bookstore. They can order it in. Just ask them. And it's available directly from us, from our Etsy shop. We're still waiting for our copies to get here for people who pre-ordered it. Thank you to everyone who pre-ordered it. But we should have our copies either this week or next, and we'll start mailing them out. Thanks, everybody, ordering, and please continue to pre-order. We like that.
That's
the best way for us.
Yeah.
But certainly, in the end, I don't mind where you get it as long as you get it. And I hope everybody likes it. 3 years of work. It's really been a journey for me. So in honor of the raccoon named Satan, we have a devilish postcard.
Yes, it says, don't worry, you're coming to see me someday. And it's quite clearly the devil.
Yeah, yeah.
He has a little devil friend, like, hanging out. It does look like a good time.
You often say one of your favorite things is the sort of 1960s psychedelic take on Victoriana.
Yeah, yeah.
This is kind of a Victorian take on psychedelia, you know?
Yeah, it's like this, that color combination is yet to be popularized.
Yeah, yeah. It's a pretty colorful image. It's pretty neat. So it's a little devil postcard. Don't worry, you're coming to see me someday. This will be our curiosity of the week. I'll take a photo of that. And I'll put it in the show notes. If you click on that, you can go to our Etsy shop where you can purchase that and other curiosities of the week, those that are left. Also at Etsy, my drawing of John Stink, you can get a print of that.
It's colorized too?
Yeah, it's a colored print of John Stink. It's titled John Stink Walks Towards Life. It's kind of him walking away from Apollo skulls. I very much like it. It's one of my favorite prints. And I was going to put that on the cover of the book, and then I thought, it probably needs to be a photo. I really want to get across to people that these are real stories. Real people. So that's why I chose a photo over that. But yeah, you can get prints of John Stink. Other artwork there, prints and originals. Copies of my books. If you get them from us on Etsy, they come signed. Strange Familiars t-shirts, stickers, patches, and more. Allison has old photos and other ephemera there. Our shop name is Lost Grave. But if you type in Strange Familiars, you should see our stuff come up anyway. Check out Allison's offerings on eBay. She's been hammering away at eBay at the Strange Familiar store there. We have links to that in the show notes as well. If you're in the area, Columbia, Pennsylvania, State Theater Vintage, Allison has her stand there. And over in Hanover, Pennsylvania, we have a stand with Chad. And my books are at both places, but we have a variety of different things at each place. Frame things. Chad has axes and wool and other woodsman-y things, knives and so forth. And Allison has fancy glass and different things at each place. Kind of a little bit different vibe with each stand, I think. You kind of have a different vibe going with each stand. So, all right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back soon with more Strange Familiars. Strange Familiars is a production of Dark Holler Arts. Intro and background music is by Stone Breath. If you want to hear more or purchase music, you can go to stonebreath.bandcamp.com. Strange Familiars is on Instagram, @strangefamiliars, one word, no underscore. Please give us a follow there. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/strangefamiliars. The Strange Familiars Gathering Group is there. Strangefamiliars.com is open all the time. And for Strange Familiars merch, just go to strangefamiliars.com/merch.